Coming up on Simply Superior.
Blue Moon.
Did you see the moon last night, or could you? And what about all the stars? The International Dark Sky Association's Starry Skies Lake Superior chapter wants to make sure they're always visible and has ideas how you and your porch light can help. Then,
got my chips cashed in.
If it's rolling down the road, sailing the lake, or flying in that starry sky, it's all a part of transportation. And even if you're sitting in your living room, it affects you. University of Wisconsin-Superior's transportation expert Richard Stewart tells us what's coming down the road. And finally, after 33 years, news from Indian country is shutting down. Publisher Paul DeMaine tells us why and what's next. Those stories coming up after this. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. The autumnal equinox happened this past week, and yes, the days are getting shorter. That's good news for the stargazers out there, but only if they can see the sky. And more than just the celestial scenery, light pollution could have an effect on all of us. My guests in the studio have a lot to say about that. With me from the International Dark Sky Association's Starry Skies Lake Superior chapter are Randy Larson and Cynthia Lapp, who a week ago marked Celebrate the Night Sky Week. Welcome, Randy.
Thanks, Robin.
And welcome, Cynthia.
Thanks, Robin.
So what can we do about it? Or tell us what the problem is in the first place. What's wrong with a little light in the sky, particularly at night?
We're losing the night sky at a rate of 4 to 10% a year around the world. 80% of the kids in North America have never seen the Milky Way. So we're there to try to turn that around.
So what does the night sky, what's it supposed to look like and what does it look like? And by the way, I mean, in the Twin Ports here, it looks a lot different than it does in Chicago.
Right. Yeah. We actually have pretty good access for a large city, but we're not that large of a city. And with the increasing sky brightness, we've lost a lot of what people could see here in the 70s and 80s and 90s, actually, already. So we're trying to turn that around and have a better visual access to the night sky. And all the phenomena that we love, northern lights, meteor showers, the Milky Way, seeing it from in town.
What's wrong with light, though? I mean, one of the things, and I know you can get to this, is public safety. And I would think conventional wisdom would tell you, right, that if you have a light on in the back porch, that dreaded burglar would say, oh, no, I'm not going to hit that house.
It's really pretty interesting, the history of people thinking about public safety and lighting. The first big advertising about lighting and public safety was that if you buy street lights, it would be like having another police force in your town. And that was put out in the 1880s by lighting companies trying to sell lights. So while there's a lot of good places and a lot of good reason to have some light at night, the condition of having brighter lights to reduce crime has never really played out anywhere.
You've got statistics on that? Or?
Oh, yeah. There's been a lot of studies done. And it can kind of go both ways overall. There's some instances where you put a light in here, a light in there, and, of course, activity may change. But overall, there's also a study that was done in Chicago. They brightened alleys to try to deter crime, and it increased crime in the places where they brightened alleys. One of the more robust studies came out of England about four years ago, where in about 64 municipalities, they did different things to save money. Some municipalities turned down the lights, some changed to LEDs, some turned off all of their streetlights altogether, and some only had them on periodically during the night. And across all municipalities, there was no change in traffic safety or in public safety.
Aside from bad people waiting for opportunities to do bad things, what about my own feeling of personal safety? So if I'm running at night, if I'm jogging or something like that, or even if I'm just taking a walk, don't I want to have the lights there to guide me? I usually would carry today my cell phone and use it as a light so that cars can see me and things like that.
We're not talking about turning the lights off. We're actually talking about intelligent use of light. with the onset of bright white LEDs, we're looking at the color spectrum of that and how it affects our circadian rhythm and also the circadian rhythm and life of animals around us.
Circadian being, I love that word, by the way. I once found some circadian association. I thought they were fascinating. But as I understand it, and you can correct me, it has to do with our normal cycles during the day, that we're tired in the morning, or we wake up in the morning, we're alert during the day, we go to sleep at night. Or if we work at night, it might be the opposite.
Yeah, there's been a lot of studies on the disruption of the circadian rhythm, and a lot of that has come via the new ability to put lights into places that weren't lit before.
It was actually shift working that was, I think, one of the first alerts to lighting as a public health issue. And that started in the 80s when they looked at massive, giant studies of shift workers. And they saw that there was an increased chance of breast cancer and prostate cancer for shift workers at night. And they couldn't figure out what it was. And they finally narrowed it down to light. So in our circadian rhythm, we're adapted to a lot of light during the day and almost no light at night, and not very bright light at night. Or
that's our natural state.
Natural state, mm-hmm. Or not blue light at night. And the blue light is, the blue spectrum is what makes new LEDs or any lights look white. You know, if you think about a prism, white light, a prism will break it into all the different colors.
Mm-hmm.
So we've adapted basically to see firelight at night. And what we're doing is we're putting these giant sort of daytime fixtures into our nighttime environment. And that really disrupts the circadian rhythm. So any bright light can disrupt it, but the blue spectrum specifically disrupt it. So we're putting a color spectrum in our environment that turns our melatonin production off. And when that melatonin production is off at night, our body doesn't go into rest and recovery mode. And that's why, for example, the AMA recommendation that came out in 2016 is that light is a contributing factor to all chronic disease.
You mentioned Chicago as being one of the places where there was a study. I grew up there, and I can remember in the 70s, giving you an idea when I grew up, this shift to sodium vapor lights. I remember it well because they made a big deal. They're sodium vapor. They're the orangey, yellowy things. Of course, you're quite familiar with them. I even used the word sodium vapor in a poem. It was a sonnet, and I actually got the right rhythm out of it somehow. But they were weird. And yet I'm wondering, they don't appear to be the blue spectrum you're talking about.
They aren't. The light is measured traditionally under a Kelvin scale. Those lights are typically, and they're in existence in Duluth, the old street lights.
The high-pressure sodium.
High-pressure sodium. Measure about 1870. The new LED
1870 degrees.
1870 Kelvin.
Okay.
The new LED lights that we see MnDOT spreading on all the freeways and a lot of the intersections in Duluth are at 4,000 Kelvin.
And some of the new ones are at 3,000. But
right.
it's still very white light, and it has a significant blue spike that we as humans and basically all life on Earth did not adapt to. So what happens when you have this bright white light is not only do you have a human maladaption to what's going on, but you create a sink that like an insect sink for wildlife, where insects will fly around until they're exhausted or dead. In Europe, there has been multiple studies coming out from different countries that they've lost 75% of their flying insect population over the last 40 years, and they think that's due mostly to lighting at night. So we're trying to curtail that and keep our insect population, because of all things that function on the earth, if we don't have insects, not much is going to work.
90% of the fireflies in North America have been decimated.
The habitat's gone just because of bright lighting. And what happens?
Not to make light of that, but even though make light of that. All right, I just did. But you're talking about a bug that has its own light too, right?
Right, and it needs the darkness because it uses its light to mate. So once it has light brighter than the light it emits, it can't mate anymore, and the habitat is gone.
We're finding that all kinds of insects, moths, bats, actually help pollinate at night. And so once we lose those insects, those critters, basically, we lose the pollination process.
Mm-hmm. And the pollination at night, when that's interrupted, it also cascades into daytime pollination and a significant lower incidence of fruit setting on plants, which we have enough pollinating crisis as it is. So adding more pollution and inhibiting night pollination is not a very good idea.
The pollination crisis being the various studies saying bees are not going where they should be or migrating in whatever ways bees are supposed to do that. I should know more about that because here at
collapsing
UWS,
right,
we've got a whole bee colony here of, I think, 500,000 or something like that. So we are talking to Randy Larson and Cynthia Lapp of the International Dark Sky Association, Starry Skies Lake Superior chapter. What do you want to see, if I may make that pun? So what should the night sky look like?
Well, this is all kind of heavy information. So one of the things we wanted to bring back in is the celebration of the night sky. And so it's just to come around to recapturing our joy and wonder of looking up at the night sky. Basically, if you grow up in any type of urbanized area now, and we have darker skies than are what's accessible to the entire eastern part of the United States. We're right on the border of having some pristine sky that you can get to. And if you're wondering, we have pretty good views around here and just outside of Duluth, but the only pristine sky left now is just up on the Canadian border along the Voyageurs National Park and Boundary Waters Quetico area, and then the northern part of Lake Superior. And everything south and east of this, all the way to the coast, is light pollution inhibited.
Hmm. And what are Duluth and Superior, A, what's the problem? How are they manifested? And B, what are they doing about it?
Well, Duluth and Minnesota Power, who both take care of streetlights in town, have said they're going to 2700 Kelvin lighting, which is what they're putting in now on the new Superior Street extension. That's good news. What we're advocating is going as warm as you can. And our talk about high pressure sodium was a good indication. That kind of lighting is, like you said, is a lot warmer than what's being put in. And that's available now. Wildlife friendly lighting, there's a program in Florida that creating lighting called wildlife-friendly lighting, and they're working with companies to produce this. And so it's very warm. It's in the amber and to warm orange-amber scale. And this is the least inhibiting for sea turtles and other activity that they have all around the Florida area, but it's also the least inhibiting. It's an average of least inhibiting for animals and humans. So we're advocating wildlife-friendly up to 2,000 or 2,200 Kelvin if you need something brighter. But again, these are whiter than what we're accustomed to. So we don't see any reason to go brighter, whiter than that. And brightness is a different scale. You can have very bright yellow lights and very dim white ones. So we're just talking about color.
Wildlife-friendly lighting has just been come onto the market in the last 6 months. So it's something that's brand new.
I'm just wondering, the bears that seem to hit our garbage cans, is wildlife-friendly lighting good for that or bad for that, or do I want that happening?
I don't think they need any lights.
Yeah. Well, the idea of wildlife-friendly is, in reality, there isn't any artificial light at night that's friendly to wildlife. Because they adapted without any artificial light. But this is the kind of the average wavelength of what we know now that's least inhibiting to their natural activity. I mean, having bears in town, that's a whole different issue. Mm-hmm. when they get habituated to what humans offer in their environment.
Are you suggesting that actually the lights that we do have encourages bears in town?
I don't know anything about how lights affect bear activity.
Okay.
But wildlife
that wasn't meant to be set up for a punchline, but yes.
Wildlife-friendly lighting, meaning it's not inhibiting their natural behavior.
The lighting, when you look at the lighting and the history of it, you look at the last 100, 150 years, and we've completely changed how we've evolved as humans and how light has been used on the planet in that amount of time. So we're in the midst of a huge experiment, and I think starting to be conscious of what the result of that lighting is.
And really that's our goal, is to be conscious about every light we put up and every light and the way we, when and where we have lighting and how long we light and what it's for.
One more part about safety, and I want to get to, I'm holding your brochure, what you can do to reduce light pollution. But again, you address the burglar is not what you would think or is counter what you would think. You said you're not suggesting I don't take a flashlight with me if I'm going to walk on the side of the road.
Oh, flashlights are great, especially red ones.
Okay.
They inhibit your vision the least. And the reason we don't recommend red streetlights is a constant red light is an interruption for bird avian activity at night. So that's why I said the orange light is kind of an average of what we now know across the world from studies is the least inhibitory color. It's the best kind of average answer right now.
So in the most practical, personal terms I can think of is my porch light that I turn on when my wife works late, particularly in the winter. But seriously, when I know somebody is coming home or a visitor is coming after dark, should I not be doing that, or is it the type of light I'm using?
If you go to an amber-colored light bulb itself and then to shield it so you don't have light trespass going to your neighbors, and it's actually pointed down, all of those things. Again, you've got light where you need it. And
I mean, it is a safety issue because you're walking up my path.
Right,
I don't want you to sue me because particularly in the winter, if you can't see
so
the ice.
So getting back to your opening comment about lighting up the sky, what we really need light for at night is surfaces. So focusing on lighting up what surfaces we need.
So
lighting up the sidewalk, lighting up the porch, lighting up the front steps, lighting up the door, that's fine. But shielding it so you're not lighting up your neighbor's sidewalk, your neighbor's porch, your neighbor's door. The house across the street.
So, or the Big Dipper.
Or the Big Dipper.
Exactly.
So how you can reduce light pollution, your brochure says, point them down. Tell us what that means.
Well, exactly that. Point them towards the ground and not angled even slightly up past horizontal because that will allow more light to go vertically. And with the new what they call full cutoff lighting with LED lights, what they're realizing is that there's enough light scattering sideways horizontally that we really need vertical shielding as well. So that's the third one, shielding them.
Okay.
But pointing them down, we've already talked about warming them up.
Warming them up is, again, using wildlife-friendly amber or maximum 2200 Kelvin in color temperature. And I suppose the lights actually have that on there somewhere, right?
Right. It's really interesting now. If you go to your lighting store, hardware store, the light box will have a little, it looks almost like a nutrition label. And it'll have actually the temperature in Kelvin right on there.
All right. And then shield them, you're about to say. Put a lampshade on your lights to avoid creating glare.
Exactly. Exactly.
And eliminate light trespass, as you just said, by lighting up only your own property, not your neighbors, too.
Right. And this goes also for streetlights. We have quite a few. I think most streetlights in town aren't shielded right now. And so we're advocating shielding all streetlights. So they're just lighting up the surfaces, again, that they're called to light up. And to your point about running or activity at night in town, we would love to see pedestrian lighting because it is not required to have lighting on streets if your traffic is below 30 miles an hour. So on most of the residential streets in Duluth, we don't actually need street lights, but we could put pedestrian lighting up to great effect.
Mm-hmm. Again, lighting the sidewalk so you can see where you're stepping.
Correct.
Exactly.
Right. Are there any things that Duluth and Superior are doing different? Not that I would pit one city against the other.
They're both excited about four public lands units on this side of the border and on Canada in our region that are applying for dark sky status, and that's going to have some really great benefits for our region.
All right. We've been talking to Randy Larson and Cynthia Lapp of the International Dark Sky Association's Starry Skies Lake Superior chapter.
Thanks for your support, Robin.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for being here. Coming up, if it moves, sails, or flies in that starry sky, it's a part of transportation, and it affects you. We'll check in with the University of Wisconsin-Superior's resident transportation guru after this. Welcome back to Simply Superior. For 33 years, News from Indian Country has offered a view of the region and the world from an indigenous perspective. Now, the Hayward-based news outlet is closing shop. Publisher and founder Paul DeMaine tells us his story and what's next for him. But first,
sometimes the light's all shining on me.
Okay, we discussed the light shining on you. Now let's talk about the long, strange trips, or our everyday ones. Transportation touches everyone, and it's definitely a concern for local residents getting ready for the reworking of the Can of Worms intersection, or, if that isn't worrisome enough, cars and trucks driving themselves, which are actually a regulation away from happening in Wisconsin. My guest in the studio is Richard Stewart, professor of transportation and logistics at the University of Wisconsin-Superior and director of the Transportation and Logistics Research Center. This is the first of occasional conversations on the subject, which happens to be one of my favorites. Welcome to Simply Superior.
Delighted to be here, Robin.
Well, I want to look at what some of the top issues transportation related in Northwest Wisconsin, Northeast Minnesota over, let's say, the next few months and maybe years as we begin to prepare for them.
Well, Robin, I like to look at this from both a short range perspective, and we're talking months, weeks and years, that time frame, and then a long term perspective, which is often decades long. And the reason we want to look at a long-term perspective, because transportation infrastructure is not built to last weeks or years, but built to last decades. And that's often what drives some of our systems. If we have a bridge that is below capacity, or we have rail lines below capacity, or any of the transportation infrastructure that's aged, below capacity, we in effect have hooked a garden hose to a fire hose, and we're only going to get what's coming through that garden hose. And we have to do that long-range planning and look ahead, as well as deal with the short-term issues, which can be substantial.
And that's what I was hinting at in my introduction, because I kind of know where we're going. Things like the Blatnik Bridge replacement, we have to start preparing for that now. It's going to affect you now, and not to mention the Can of Worms, which is already beginning its process of change, let's just put it that way.
Well, just to give the perspective of the driver heading over to Blatnik Bridge, which I do every day, and
it is a great drive, by the way. I decided, you know what, we got a pretty good commute.
You have a fabulous view of two wonderful communities working together, and the Blatnik Bridge is an example of this bi-community, bi-state process. A lot of people don't know that under the federal planning system and requirements, we do all our transportation planning through the Metropolitan Interstate Committee as a joint planning effort. So the Blatnik Bridge is just an absolute great example of this. It's built in the 70s. It's at the end of its useful lifespan, and it's going to have to be replaced. And it divides between the two states. So each state's going to fund a portion of the bridge. They're going to be active in the design of the bridge, how it will look to the general public. Both states are involved because the funding is there. And you have all this access of the thousands, tens of thousands of people use it who have to make approaches. So when we talk about the interchange system, which we locally call the Can of Worms, and they're going to redo that over the next 3 years, it also has to be redone so it fits into the approaches for a new Blatnik Bridge. And you get down into the bridge design, and we've got some wonderful DOTs who are working on this.
DOTs?
Departments of Transportation.
Okay.
And you ask really basic questions about strength of the bridge, decking, and all this, but you actually get, what kind of lights do we want to have in the bridge? How do we want it to look at night when it's lit up? You know, questions like this. And they're out even now seeking public input on this, because we, the users of the bridge, we're the ones who look at it. We get a voice in how they're built.
So I'm thinking things like changes to the Can of Worms interchange would mean going eastbound. People don't seem to use eastbound, westbound around here, but whatever it is, Wisconsin bound, it would dictate or would actually help determine how much traffic is in each lane, right? And that would have something to do with the balance of how much weight you're going to put on each side of the bridge. I'm speculating on that, but I like to believe it's informed speculation.
Well, without getting into a lot of the engineering equations that are involved, the bridge has a capacity limit. You want to make sure you don't exceed that capacity limit. And you want to make sure that traffic flows smoothly. Now, we did some repairs to the bridge a while back, so the DOTs are actually very good at preparing this. The problem is that we as individuals working, as citizens working with the agencies on this, you'd made the comment earlier, Robin, about transportation affecting this. I'll be even bolder and tell you and ask the audience, what can you do without transportation? Just call in, tell me what you can do without transportation except breathing.
I can sit at home and watch TV.
No, you can't, because okay. You won't have a home, because everything to build it had to be transported. All the supplies for your TV had to be transported. All your clothes are transported. It's the backbone of our economy. It's the great hidden empire that we pay no attention to until you go to the shelf and it's not there, and you go, why is it not there? And the reason usually is a transportation issue. Occasionally it's manufacturing, but often transportation. So transportation is what keeps our civilization moving. And so we have to keep that civilization moving even when we're reconstructing the Blatnik Bridge or reconstructing a can of worms. And we're going to have to move the wind turbine parts, which are sitting in the port of Duluth, all the products that's moving out of the Superior area and heading across, the stuff that's moving from northeast Minnesota and is now headed over to Wisconsin and Chicago markets. That's a very complex undertaking to have minimum impact on not only our everyday lives, but all this freight that moves.
And this thing costs a little bit of money, too. It costs a little more to build a Blatnik Bridge today than it did in the 70s, I take it?
Well, everything has increased in price due to inflation. We all kind of take this for granted. When you bought a car in the 70s, it was a lot cheaper than buying a car now. One of the unfortunate aspects we're dealing with is funding of transportation infrastructure is not one entity. As I mentioned, we're doing bi-state. Well, this is also an I-353, so that means that there's federal funding involved.
And that should be a good thing, right?
Well, it is a good thing. It's a critical element of our infrastructure. But you just pointed out to me that costs have increased since 1970. We haven't increased a federal gasoline tax in 25 years. So we're trying to use revenue from 25 years ago to pay for cement, asphalt, steel, that is not at the same price it was 25 years ago. So there is a current shortfall in the Highway Trust Fund. We can't keep up with these expenditures if we're not willing to pay the cost of materials and labor to get the job done.
I'm going to be another devil's advocate. Couldn't we just shut the bridge down for the time it takes to rehab it and, okay, go use the bong? We do have two bridges.
There will likely come a period where we have to do that. And actually, we have three bridges. We also have the Oliver Street Bridge at the far end, which could be used by some of the
scenic route.
Well, people use it currently, and more traffic may move there, but it has some issues for freight traffic and clearance and other things. And it's a circuitous route going through areas that don't normally get heavy traffic. So, yes, it's possible we'll have to close it down for as short a period of time as possible.
All right. Well, there's the Blatnik for now. In the short-term look at it, we're talking to Professor Richard Stewart, who is a professor of transportation and logistics here at the University of Wisconsin-Superior. What else is coming down the pike, if we will?
Well, another infrastructure change that's taking place that's not physically here in the Twin Ports, but will have a tremendous impact on the Twin Ports, is the building of the new lock at the Sault Ste. Marie. Currently, we have one lock that can fit the large ships, the 1,000-footers, 800. Anything that's bigger than seaway size, which is Seaway ships are about 775 feet long by 76-foot beam. And
I like to say, even though you got a little bit technical there, this is something that every, 10-year-old in the Twin Ports knows, right? They know the names of all the boats. You can't grow up here without this. And they know that Salties are smaller than Lakers, right?
Right.
We all know that.
Well, just in case somebody outside the Twin Ports was listening, I wanted to give a little bit of detail that we have a plug in the bottle, if you will. At the current, there's only 1,000-foot lock at the Sioux. If it gets damaged or anything that happens to it, our coal markets, our taconite markets, our aggregate markets will be severely adversely impacted, losing tens of thousands of jobs, hundreds of millions of dollars, closing down steel mills, everything else. So finally, after years of study, first driven by Oberstar and others, they've decided to rebuild a second 1,000-foot lock. When that's done, we will be able to have one lock open and one lock closed for repairs. Currently, as you mentioned, everybody in the Twin Ports knows, we close down the locks from January 15th through March 25th in order to do repairs. That's mandated.
For weather, or is it not for weather?
Well, that brings up another interesting topic that will start hour two of our radio program, and that's climate change. Over the past decade, there's been years when the Lakers could have operated year-round.
Mm-hmm. But not last year.
No, absolutely not. But if we went back a couple of other years, the new Sioux Lock provides opportunity to operate year-round if conditions weren't. But the most important thing is that it prevents the serious economic damage that would occur to our region and all the Great Lakes if that lock closed.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a tremendous infrastructure benefit that's being done out of our sight, but certainly not out of our minds.
And going back to another basic that everybody, of course, all the 10-year-olds or maybe 9-year-olds in our area already know, the reason for the lock is that lake levels are different, correct? Well, this is what nature does. Water flows downhill.
Well, what you've got is the St. Mary's Rapids on the St. Mary's River that connects Lake Huron to Lake Superior. And you have a drop depending on lake levels, and that's why we've had locks there since 1855. Erie and Michigan and Huron are all the same lake level. Ontario's a different lake level. We have this little thing called Niagara Falls.
I've heard of that.
Yeah.
Or both look great going over that, don't they?
So everything moves from the head of the lakes downbound to the lower lakes, and that bottleneck is the Sioux.
Right, and the locks is the way that you move those ships up and down.
It's the only way you move them up and down.
Again, we're talking to Professor Richard Stewart, Transportation and Logistics here at the University of Wisconsin-Superior. What else is on the horizon? You gave me a list here, so I won't pretend that I'm not holding it in my hand. We're talking about technological changes that we'll be seeing. And we got one that's been rolling around here in a federal test of electric battery buses. We've reported about that. The DTA has been testing them out because we have cold weather, and if the battery buses can work here, they can probably work anywhere. What's on the technological horizon?
Well, a couple of things. For all of us who own cars, every year we see added safety features in the car. And a little basic primer on automation, people talk about it. The automotive engineers has five levels of automation. The first level is really pretty basic. You have something like cruise control in your car, and we turn on the cruise control, take our foot off the gas pedal, and the car moves along over hills and hill and dale at the speed we set. We don't even think about it anymore. Level two, we add cruise control, and it interacts with forward-seeking radar, so that car gets too close ahead of us for whatever reason, automatically the cruise control cuts our speed and slow down so we don't approach too closely.
Right. It's been called adaptive cruise control. It was a big deal when I reported about driverless cars, 3 years ago, yeah. And some of that stuff is in the public consciousness and some isn't, right?
And level three is we're able basically to take our hands off the wheel and the car drives. Uber's tested some of these. They're not out on the consumer market quite yet. I will tell you this, that the automotive industry, the major producers of cars, really don't like the idea of level three. And the reason they don't like the idea of level three is because we're human beings.
Right. This is a mix of both automation and humans.
It is in some ways the worst of all worlds because the car is driving, or truck, I should add, car or truck is driving itself along the highway. And the expectation is if something goes wrong, you will immediately take over and take control and get out of the situation. Well, that sounds really nice on paper, but the reality is humans are just terrible at watching dials for hours on end. And so we will probably pick up a book, maybe look at the screen, maybe do
watch a movie.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I laughed there, but that apparently may have been a factor in the first Tesla crash, where or fatality, I should say. And then the second thing that I think really affected the public confidence of self-driving vehicles was the Uber crash, where they did have a human operator doing exactly what you just alluded to, if there was a situation to take over. But by the time he looked up to see the woman on the bicycle, it was too late.
Yeah, you're right. That's all level three stuff. And airplanes have been operating at level three for a long time. We'd all get very twitchy if we thought the pilot was reading a book or playing a video game instead of watching the dials. And that same onus of operation would happen for motorists. So
you just hit on airplanes and, of course, trains and ships. And these are vehicles that are in our area that are already doing self-driving to some degree.
Yes, they're all right about level three, and many have been for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
40 years ago, I commanded ships that had unmanned engine rooms, and we had all pilots on the bridge and one person on the bridge looking out for trouble. But that's all you did. And you had to be available at a moment's notice to take corrective action. This is a difficult thing to do. So I, in my crystal ball, which is always a little cloudy, but in my crystal ball, I see us moving as quickly as we can to level four, where in all likelihood, the car won't even have a steering wheel for you to touch. It'll be programmed to go where it needs to go. And that automation raises in automobiles and trucks and all these raise all kinds of issues, because will the automated systems be black boxes that your local mechanic can't touch? They just plug in, send off for repair somewhere else. A lot of unanswered questions, but there are some other things that are happening in foreign countries and here. We've been practicing truck platooning in the United States and several states for some time.
And I was going to ask you, is that happening here?
What truck platooning is, the first truck is monitoring the road and driving. The second truck is electronically linked to it with wireless systems, follows close behind it in the 10-meter range behind it, and then maybe a third truck behind it in 10 meters.
Like a coupled train car, except they're coupled electronically.
A truck train, if you want to call it. That's mm-hmm. fine. Each truck can separate from the other one to go off and on different locations. Each one has a driver. But once again, it's level three, so they have to pay attention the whole time to what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
They've been doing this in Europe. They've been doing it in certain states in the United States. The state of Wisconsin and the state of Minnesota have had committees looking into it. Interestingly enough, in the state of Wisconsin, we could have truck platooning tomorrow if we changed the regulation on the distance of separation of trucks. There's no other barrier to doing truck platooning tomorrow.
Hmm.
From a legal point of view, from an operational point of view, frankly, the idea of three trucks close together on a two-lane highway, forget it. You'll have accidents, people trying to pass. So when it does occur, it will probably be limited to only four-lane highways so that the average motorist can get by this three trucks tied together.
All right. So we should all be prepared, or at least expecting change to happen. Thank you so much, Richard Stewart.
My pleasure.
We've been speaking with Richard Stewart, professor of transportation and logistics at the University of Wisconsin-Superior and director of the Transportation and Logistics Research Center. Coming up, news from Indian Country files its last report. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. For 33 years, News from Indian Country has offered a view of the region and the world from an indigenous perspective. Now, the Hayward-based news outlet is closing shop. Publisher and founder Paul DeMaine joined my WPR colleague Rob Ferret on Central Time this week to tell why and what's next. Here's their conversation.
Since 1986, News from Indian Country has served Native American communities from its base in northern Wisconsin. According to editor and CEO Paul DeMaine, the publication has covered topics including ironworkers, spearfishing, casinos, federal recognition, hemp, taxes, treaty rights, boarding schools, corruption, and many others. But after 33 years, DeMaine announced that the August 2019 issue would be the news source's last. In a letter on the outlet's website, he called the run, quote, a wild, wise, and wonderful ride. Paul DeMaine joins us now from Hayward. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. And please, people listening in, make your pledge to keep the news on the air.
Paul,
it helps.
Thank you. That's very nice of you to say. Well, I want to start by saying, I guess, condolences. I mean, you've put your heart and soul into this for three decades. How are you feeling now that it's over?
Well, it's not quite over yet. Certain parts of it are over, but I'm going through what is going to be about 45 years of writing materials. I started writing about American Indians and other issues when I was in high school at Wausau West High School and 16 years old and editor of, I think they called it the Clarion at the time. And I tend to be a pack rat on source documents and information, so I'm actually discovering repositories of information that are very valuable. So I want to spend some time in the next 3 or 4 months going through that and sorting out. I mean, I've got collections of reel-to-reels that people gave me because they thought I could find something to do with them at the time. And they're even out more moded even more than they were at the time when I received them. VHS, DAT tapes, cassette tapes. And, you know, I had this wonderful privilege of speaking to people and speaking to issues and learning about issues across North America. Actually, the Western Hemisphere is what we covered, indigenous affairs from the Maori all the way up to the establishment of Nunavut as another province in Canada. So we've covered everything, but I've had a privilege to sit down and interview leaders that have passed on, like Oneida Percy Paulus and Hillary Walkaw, the Menominee, and so many more people whose information and source documentation is underutilized and on a disk somewhere where it needs to be made public. So I'm going to spend some time trying to archive and inventory and see where some of these materials ought to go. So it's really kind of fascinating running through it. We've got something like 10,000 photos laying around our office, and we've got to figure out where some of that stuff goes here in the next few weeks and months.
Now, how would you describe News from Indian Country's mission over the last 30 plus years?
Well, I think it was kind of formulated probably in 1973 when I was in high school and I was reading articles produced by the Associated Press, for example, about the Wounded Knee takeover in Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. And another publication produced by Mohawk people out in New York called Akwesasne Notes. In Akwesasne Notes, you'd have 4 or 5 pages of information, materials. They talked about treaty rights. They talked about grievances. They talked about the lack of jobs, the lack of education, all these other issues that help raise to the issue and the occupation of Wounded Knee, South Dakota, in a very symbolic event in 1973, covered worldwide during, I think, 72 days of occupation of that little hamlet. And then looking at the Associated Press, which, you know, kind of reflected a situation in which violent protesters had invaded this village and taken it over, and how short and sweet the facts are. And there were the facts, you know, who, where, what, when, and why kind of a thing. But they lacked, I think, the integrity of a background and sourcing and history. And so I think it was as early as high school that I said, you know, if I ever have a chance to own my own newspaper, that's what I want to do. And I want to give voice to the indigenous community. So it's their voice that's being projected and not a 5 to 10 second clip on television or a short radio interview or some kind. We're going to be on for 15 minutes. I'm not going to be able to explain a whole lot of things during that time period. So I wanted to expand on the capability so that people had a better understanding of indigenous affairs and native history that comes from their own backyard.
In the run of News from Indian Country, there were some stories, a lot of coverage, looked at positive things and community building within Native groups and among Native groups. But you also tried to hold tribal government's feet to the fire. You covered stories of corruption. Talk about that balancing act where you're trying to reflect the positive but not overlook the bad stuff.
No, I think we wanted to sit back and look at those basic covenants of journalism, and that is to try to be fair and balanced and give people a chance to discuss things and allow the public to formulate their position. But certainly, we were not afraid to deal with our own laundry in our backyard. So we did articles about tribal leaders involved in drugs and drug dealing, embezzlements, all the things that impair society in a regular way. We weren't afraid to hang out our own laundry. In fact, I like the idea that it was indigenous people holding other indigenous people accountable. Yes, we discussed mascot issues as a national issue. Yes, we've covered the revival of languages as an issue, and it's in all its depth and revival and what it represents. We've done beautiful stories about people doing beautiful things, but we also dug into the dirt of the community. We had to cover trials for people on murder, embezzlement, drug dealing, and some of those people were public leaders, and it didn't always make people happy. So IRS says we had something for everyone. We had good, bad, and ugly in our publication, but it's simply a reflection of the indigenous community, as is any community. Probably one of the most startling cases that we worked with in depth with Richard LaCourse, a Yakima native who used to work with the William Randolph Hearst newspaper in San Francisco, and a couple of other native journalists took on a review of the Leonard Peltier case. And we went into it after many, many years of support, all 5 or 6 of us, believing that Leonard Peltier might have been railroaded and framed, only to end up interviewing some women, which Peltier had bragged to about shooting the agents. And one of the women in that group ended up being executed within 6 months of that event. We have since tied her murder to the suppression of evidence in the shooting of the two FBI agents. In fact, the fact that she was a recipient of Peltier bragging to her. When I first heard that, and the first time I heard that specifically was in an interview with Denver with one of the women Peltier had bragged to, I went down the highway and pulled over, and I just asked the question, why me? Why me? And I said, okay, I had to think about it for a while, about what this all meant, because I knew that it would make me someone in the tribal community that was looked down upon by some people who had pledged their political lives, their social lives, to trying to free this guy. So it was a difficult case, but the pursuit of the truth in this matter was what we were looking at, and I think that's what we achieved.
Talking to Paul DeMaine, Managing Editor and CEO of News from Indian Country, which has published its last edition after over 30 years. Paul, out on the landscape, are there other Indian Native American news sources that you're watching, that you look to?
Well, I'm looking at the Indian Country TV, Indian Country Media Network, which is the old Indian Country Today publication, which quit publishing newsprint several years ago, went to an online digital format, and is now housed out of the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism in Arizona. And they're trying to revive and work with digitalization and video to save themselves. I mean, we've lost in Indian Country 20 years ago, we had 700 publications. We probably got 150, 180 left. Many of those are public relations type news publications. And so you're going to get a lot of good news. You're going to get political perspectives from some of them. But the other thing is with the digital age comes all kinds of voices. You can look and see people posting stuff that's factual news. Takes a little bit of work sometimes to figure out and vet that news for accuracy and everything, but I think that'll evolve. But it was really the internet that changed the dynamic of news from Indian country, and we've lost more than 60% of those publications that were in Indian country as either private or tribal private enterprises of some kind.
So for the reasons for closing now, it sounds like you're going through the same issues that many newspapers have gone through over the last 10 or 15 years, as you mentioned, in part because of the internet.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's part of it. And part of it is after 40 some years of covering Indian country, I thought maybe I wanted to do something else and get out of that news grind. Some people live it until the very end. I've been involved in so many activities and seen so many things in Indian country. I've covered the food sovereignty movement. I really enjoy it. I tap trees myself. I just got done inoculating some oak trees with mushroom spawn this morning on the property I own. So there's plenty to do. There's plenty of opportunities to produce maybe a video podcast or something in the future, but I just want to take some time off after this and think about doing something different. I think I'm tired of the pursuit of trying to change from the old publishing format into the digitized format. It's time for someone younger to come along. We gave voice to some 400 or more writers over the years. And I'm very proud of the fact that we had at one point 17 employees. I've graduated some of those employees from the original 418K Macintosh computer into a computer world, and they've gone off and made a living. And those are the real important things, you know, to be able to see someone who's come and gone and is thriving in the community. We created jobs. We created economic stimulus. We gave hope to people. And so I think we've accomplished a lot, but it's time to do something different.
Well, Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you much. Appreciate it as well.
That was News from Indian Country publisher and founder Paul DeMaine with WPR's Rob Ferret on Central Time earlier this week. And that's it for this week's show. We leave you with more of the music of jazz singer Pippi Ardina, the featured performer at last week's Celebrate the Night Sky Week throughout the Lake Superior region. Here is Pippi.
Blue moon, you saw me standing alone without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own.